Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to people from some of the wonderful organizations in Santa Fe, like La Familia Medical Center, Southwest Care, and the Santa Fe Rape Crisis Center. Right now, I would like to welcome, joining us by telephone, Robert Arellano. He is the author of the new novel, Havana Lunar, and he will be speaking today, Monday, February 23rd, at 4 in the afternoon at the University of New Mexico Student Union Building Isleta Room in Albuquerque, and then again tomorrow at Bookworks on Rio Grande Boulevard in Albuquerque. Welcome, Robert, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So you set this novel in Havana, Cuba, during the so-called special period. What was that period, and how did you decide to set the book in that place and time?
Oh, yeah. Bueno, el periodo especial is what Fidel called it. And it was something, a term Fidel Castro came up with to talk about the economic austerity that hit Cuba right after they began losing subsidies from the Soviet Union. So we were all aware of 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, but the implications for Cuba just a year or two later were no more help, no more oil for sugar from the Soviet Union. And that's when I started to visit Cuba. I made 10 trips to Havana, Pinar del Rio, Varadero, all those places during the 1990s and the early part of this decade. And so I got to see the special period from its inception really into its darkest days in the mid-90s, and then the recovery that began to come over Cuba near the turn of the millennium. Just a few years back, things started to improve.
So what was it about that really captured your imagination to the point where you wanted to write a novel?
So many things are striking about visits to Cuba, and you know, I don't always out people who've been to Cuba, but we both know people who visited Cuba.
Well, I certainly have as a journalist covering music and dance and as a student of music and dance.
That's right. And right there you mentioned two of the provisions. People always ask me, how can I get to Cuba? And I say, well, there's still three visas, journalist, student, and diplomat. So, you know, usually we can fit into one or two of those. When I was visiting Cuba, I was just struck by the Cuban tendency para resolver, to resolve or to, you know, to make ends meet. And that happens at the level of not just, you know, the common blue-collar workers. That happens at the level of great, you know, people who we consider professionals beyond the need to worry about their finances. Doctors, as in the case of the hero of my novel, a guy named Mano Rodriguez, is a physician in the National Medical Service, and I met people like him who were just trying to make ends meet day to day because of the economic shortages of the special period in Havana.
You write in English with a heavy sprinkling of Spanish. Tell us about this choice. It's not like Spanglish, which you read in border literature. It's a different kind of writing.
Sure. Well, thanks. Yeah, I sometimes like to call it Inglañol. Just to use a different term from Spanglish, maybe that's what a native Spanish speaker would call the hybrid language, like Inglés mixed with Español, Inglañol.
Right.
I got to say, I very consciously went into this project saying, this is going to be a dual language book. I use the term dual language because when you say a bilingual book, people think they maybe need to be bilingual in order to appreciate it or to get the whole story. Well, here I think there's just enough context so that even though there's short passages in Spanish and then, you know, largely in English, the novel allows someone who doesn't have very much Spanish at all to figure out certainly the mystery at the heart of the book by the context and by reading closely. But at the same time, there'll be sort of an extra level of pleasure for someone who does read both English and Spanish, or even who has just a little bit of Spanish conversationally or, you know, casually understanding some phrases here and there, living in the multilingual culture we do. So those phrases and those words, this is going to be the test for me, whether it plays before the audience at UNM and at Bookworks tomorrow night. And whether I get interrupted for questions, to some degree, I'm trying to do what authors like Sandra Cisneros and even Oscar Hiuelos, another Cuban-American author, have done for a long time. But I'm not using the italics. I'm not peppering my prose with lots of words that are sort of self-consciously foreign language words. I'm saying, hey, this is a single language, Inglañol or Spanglish or whatever you'll call it, that I think those of us who live in northern New Mexico know well, even if we don't necessarily consider it our primary language.
Well, yeah, and it's here it's a different thing because I don't know if any linguist has ever done a study of New Mexican Spanglish, but there are certain words that you always, if you're speaking Spanglish, that you say in Spanish and certain other words that you always say in English, and it seems to have almost its own kind of syntax, whereas what you're doing is taking a story that would be told entirely in Spanish, but since you are writing in English, you're making it both.
Oh yeah, I'd like to think so. And I think it's greater than either language in isolation to acknowledge that we have this language. In some ways, living in northern New Mexico for the last 5 years emboldened me to use this approach of dual language because, you know, I realized I can do it without making either the single language English or the single language Spanish reader feel alienated from the book. And so a lot of it's in dialogue. As you know, there's, you know, characters like Aurora, the nursemaid of the hero character in the flashbacks, who quotes lines from the Manicero, que calientico y rico está, ya no se puede pedir más. But that's going to be mixed in with, you know, description in English as well as a little bit of exposition in Spanish and English.
Now, one of the characters in the book is a teenage jinetera, and that's a word for which we don't have an exact translation into English. What are jineteros?
Okay. Yeah, the jinetera, that's right. There's not an exact translation. The closest thing is actually a literal translation would be rider, like horseback rider, although what it tends to refer to is my favorite word in English would probably be streetwalker. It doesn't necessarily mean prostitute. It doesn't necessarily mean hustler, but rather someone who in Havana in the 90s and to this day was looking to meet usually foreigners, not just to hook up, but to go out and get access to some of the nightclubs and some of the shops that were available to foreigners only throughout the 1990s in Havana. A very strange, almost kind of apartheid culture, what they called the dollar apartheid, existed in Havana for most of the 90s, where foreigners were the only ones who could carry dollars, but most of the goods and services available in the cities were only available to foreigners. And so, therefore, people, you know, boys, girls, men, women of all backgrounds aligned themselves with foreigners sometimes in order to be able to resolver and make ends meet. And the jinetera was one particular example about that, you know, sometimes favors of affection were involved, but not necessarily always. Sometimes it was more what we would call an escort role that jinetera or jinetero would take on. And so it is hard to explain, and in some ways fiction and literature, this book will give you a better idea of the nuances of that role and how it distinguishes from anything we might have heard of before and don't have language for in our own English necessarily.
And I was thinking under what circumstances could an American understand that, and it's sort of hard to imagine, but if, for example, the United States went into a very great economic depression and the only people who were supporting us were travelers from other countries, suddenly we'd be a country full of jineteros. But the jinetera in this book ends up in trouble with a pimp, and it's more like what we think of as maybe American-style prostitution. Is this realistic?
the trouble with the pimp is indeed a part, maybe a more of a an example of what happened a little later into the special period, where with so much crime, you know, things become corrupted largely because it's recognized by bad people as an opportunity to make a profit. So there are also chulos in Havana, what we would call a pimp. And there were examples I saw, although I didn't meet anyone in particular necessarily, who were told, oh, you've been a jinetera or jinetero in this neighborhood for the last couple of months or years. Well, you're going to need protection now because they're starting to crack down more. And so just like we would imagine happening in the cities among sort of disenfranchised young women who don't know where to go when they came for the first time to the, you know, to the street. Similarly, it happened in Havana in the 90s, although this is an extraordinary circumstances that leads to extraordinary crime, and I guess that's what makes it a mystery novel.
How do you, an American author of Cuban ancestry, go to Cuba and start researching the deep, scary, underground crime world? I mean, it sounds like a recipe for an author's self-destruction. You can get in trouble doing stuff like that.
Yeah, right. you know what's funny is that there were so many people in the 90s just talking about jineterismo, for example, just saying, oh, gosh, I know a cousin who's doing it, and she's helping her parents put food on the table. That it was common conversation, and even especially in Cuba, I was amazed at the level of just conversation that would happen in your own home. No one was afraid to talk about what was wrong with the country as long as, you know, the doors were closed. And one of my favorite little details is even when the doors were closed, very few people would ever use the name Fidel or Castro. There's always a shorthand for when you're talking about el comandante, which is you, in the middle of the sentence, pause and rub your chin as if you had a beard. So someone would say, oh, you know, bueno, tenemos que hacer algo sobre las jineteras. We have to do something about the jineteras, but it's going to be up to, and then they'd pause and rub their chin, and you know it meant the comandante. So I overheard conversations like this one on page 81, very briefly, describing what a jinetera is. Mano asks Julia, so do you pick up men along Quinta Avenida for fun? And Julia replies, for fun, yes, and sometimes money. But I'm not a prostitute. I'm a jinetera. There's a difference. I don't sleep with anyone I don't want to, and I don't set a price. That kind of business is a barbarity of capitalism.
We're talking to Robert Arellano about his new movie, Havana Lunar. So your family left Cuba in 1960. You were born and raised in the United States. And it's a funny and interesting position to be writing about a place which is both yours and not yours. Mm. How do you feel when you're there? Are you a foreigner? What's it like for you?
That was the question I had when I took that very short flight, just 90, you know, less, 45 minutes from Miami to Havana the first time in 1992. What is it going to be like? How am I going to be received here? I really wasn't sure. I had heard stories from my cousins in Miami and New York about, you know, the brainwashed island of brainwashed souls, etc. Well, when I first got there, I got to tell you, I realized I had come home. You know, there is really something, and I think it doesn't limit itself to Spanish or any language. There's something called patria, which is even if a place isn't your birthplace, you know it's your fatherland when you get there, largely because of the people. And so for me, wondering whether I was going to be able to integrate to some degree with the people, even though I was an American citizen who would leave after 2 or 4 weeks of visit each time, from the very first day, I had that question solved and answered for me with the people who said, who guessed where I was from taxi drivers to the person who cleared the table at the little homegrown restaurant I'd eat at, you know, and they would guess usually because there weren't many American citizens, 3 or 4 other nationalities before they would get to estadounidense, and I'd say yes, and they'd, you know, universally the response was, you've got to tell people there that we Cubans and you Americans have a lot in common. And the thing between the governments es otra cosa. It's another thing. It doesn't relate. And someday we're all going to have a big pachanga to get together when the governments work out their things. And that's the sort of joy, I think, that's at the heart of even a kind of a suspenseful and occasionally noir, dark mystery like Havana Lunar, that there's people who, for strange political reasons, have been kept isolated from us for 50 years now, but who we're bound for a reunion with, maybe sooner than later. And when we do, there's a whole culture that's just been a mystery that we're going to get to rediscover. And I think that's going to be true for people all across the United States. Cuba is our neighbor, but they're so far the strangers next door for the people of our generation.
Another thread in the book is a black magic spell that is put on one of the people, on the character, by a practitioner of Palo Monte,
yes,
which is a Central African form of Afro-Cuban religion, but also really dark black magic. I mean, when I've been there, everybody has said to me, stay away from people who do palo, don't even go, you know.
Yeah.
And so I found it odd that a medical doctor, who's your main character, would give this any credence in the first place.
Sure. And I think Mano even addresses how ironic it is that in an island like Cuban, even a cool scientist can tend to be superstitious, if nothing else, then because of the power of collective hallucination. Like, if everyone around you believes in a curse, even if you don't believe in that curse, strange things might start happening to you just because of the fact that we're all part of this sort of collective consciousness that affects us. So I think Mano's question at the heart of the curse by the palero, the practitioner of Palo Monte, and you're right to identify this is a big religion and a dark religion. A lot of people have heard of Santeria, but the dark side, which is almost as current in modern Cuba in terms of people who are practitioners, is Palo Monte. And these are the folks who steal skulls from the cemeteries because they believe they have magic properties and can put curses on you from, you know, making you sick or immobile to making you have a cursed love life, which is the case with our hero Mano. And so the question for Mano is, well, is this really a curse? Because I frankly seem to be living through exactly what the palero said the effects of the curse would be. And so even as he resists believing in the superstition, he has to root around the apartment to find the evidence of his estranged ex-wife's participation in the curse.
And meanwhile, he has an ongoing dialogue with a poster of Che Guevara.
El Che, sí. And that poster, you know, it's not unusual to find Cubanos in Havana and all over the island with pictures of Che or Fidel still hanging up. I mean, legitimate heroes, not just for show, in this generation of the last 50 years of Cuba. But Che in particular opened up a possibility for me to let Mano think out loud, literally, by talking to the poster and believing that he heard what the poster would say back to him. It's almost like if you had a little tattoo on your knuckles, what would Che say or what would Che do?
Right.
Mano does that all the time out loud with his poster until his poster stops talking to him.
Right.
Because even the poster makes a judgment that, you know, Mano has gone too far at a certain point when he allows the jinetera into the home and gets involved with the criminals. So El Che here, seremos como El Che is the big saying that every school child learns from the time they can speak. We will be like Che. And Mano is conflicted on that score, too, whether to believe in the superstitions of Palo Monte, but also whether to keep going when his personal life has gotten so difficult in the project, you know, that seems to be dwindling of the revolution, bringing some kind of change to the island of Cuba and the people as a whole. He doesn't know if his place in it is really all that rosy the way Che said it would be, and so he's talking to the ghost of Che through the person of the poster on his wall.
So what were some of your literary inspirations for this book? You used the word noir, which people think of film noir and detective novels in that genre.
Yeah, and partly because my publisher, Akashic, has made a very good niche for themselves in the independent publishing world with a series of noir books. And so I've read, including a collection by my friend, the Cuban-American author Achi Obejas, I've read Havana Noir, this collection out of Cuba, contemporary writers of dark and mystery and crime fiction. But my other inspirations, I picked up on a vintage, that is the United States publishing company Vintage, reissue series of noir fiction from the 40s, 50s, 60s. This is the stuff we think of with Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, but other names like Jim Thompson, you know, who wrote novels as well as screenplays for Francis Ford Coppola, David Goodis, titles like Shoot the Piano Player and Black Friday. These are sort of the heart of American noir, which, coming to think of it, was coming out of the period right before we lost contact with Cuba in the mid-1950s. So maybe there's something to that time period that we can return to now. that we seem to, in all over the world, be sort of entering a new post-depression, or hopefully not too long ago from now, post-depression era. That's where this noir came out of, and there's some classic texts both coming out of Latin America today as well as that came out of America 50 years ago.
What are your hopes for Cuba and Cuban-American relations?
Oh, yeah, I would identify myself, and it's not always popular to say this in Miami, where my mom lives, for instance, but I would identify myself as a dialoguero. That's what the Cubans, both in Cuba and in Miami, call someone who wants dialogue. There are others who say, hasta que se muera Fidel, ningún diálogo. They just don't want any dialogue or any talk of opening of relations until Fidel is out of there because of his demon status in many of my parents' generation's minds. I hope that we do see an opportunity to do more cultural exchange, which was facilitated 20 years ago by the Helms-Burton Law, and that was what allowed me and people, journalists and students like you to travel to Cuba throughout the 90s, for instance. I hope we see the opportunity to visit Cuba again, no longer a rigmarole of going through different airports and having to fly through third countries, but, there are people who've told me from Key West it would be a hour-long hydrofoil ride. A speedboat could take you to Havana in 1 hour, and wouldn't that be amazing to see that kind of cultural exchange open up again, not just from Florida, but from, from Mexico and from Texas and the Gulf, to be able to actually visit our strangers next door again and begin, as a result, to enjoy the music, to enjoy the literature, to enjoy the culture and dance and everything that's been isolated from us for half a century.
Robert Arellano is the author of the new novel Havana Lunar, and he will be speaking today, Monday, February 23rd at 4 o'clock at the University of New Mexico Student Union Building Isleta Room, and then again tomorrow at Bookworks on Rio Grande Boulevard in Albuquerque at 7 in the evening. Robert, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, fue un placer. Mucho gusto.
Muchas gracias. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR.